Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I would only say that we're doing extremely well in that negotiation, but you never know with Iran because we negotiate with them and then we always have to blow them up.
President Trump plans to address the nation tonight on Iran. Will the war be over in a few weeks? Will there be a ground invasion? Will the Strait of Hormuz remain closed? We'll speak with Ali Vaez of the International Crisis Group. Then from black rain falling on Tehran to threats on desalination plants, we'll speak to an Iranian environmental scientist who just won the Stockholm Prize, considered the Nobel Prize for water.
Emerging in many places, what we see is a persistent failure state where water systems can no longer realistically return to their historical baselines. We call this condition global water bankruptcy.
Then days after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth prayed for overwhelming violence against U.S. enemies, Pope Leo condemned the war on Iran and said warmongers have blood on their hands. We'll go to Ramallah to speak with Reverend Isaac Munther about Christian nationalism and more. And finally, 3,800 meatpacking workers are on strike in Greeley, Colorado, demanding better pay and conditions. We'll go to Colorado. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump claimed Tuesday U.S. forces would end operations in Iran very soon, saying it could take 2 to 3 weeks. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, told Al Jazeera he has no faith in talks with the U.S. and says while he's exchanged messages with Washington, there are no negotiations currently underway. On Tuesday, Israel struck a major pharmaceutical company in Tehran. Israel claimed the plant's responsible for developing chemical weapons. This comes as the USS George H.W. Bush deployed to the Middle East Tuesday, along with three destroyers, according to two U.S. officials speaking to the AP. The carrier strike group consists of more than 6,000 service members. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth held a news briefing at the Pentagon Tuesday morning and launched into a prayer for U.S. troops in the region.
May God watch over all of them each day and each night. May his almighty and eternal arms of providence stretch over them and protect them and bring them peace. In the name of Jesus Christ, and amen.
President Trump's expected to address the nation tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. It comes as several European nations have refused to back the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran. France has blocked Israeli planes from flying weapons through its airspace, while Italy refused last-minute permission for U.S. bombers to land in Sicily. Spain has consistently denied the U.S. use of its bases and airspace for the war. And on Tuesday, Spain's defense minister said Spain will not accept lectures from anyone. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer also pledged the United Kingdom will not be dragged into the war in Iran. In an interview with The Telegraph Tuesday, President Trump said he's strongly considering pulling out of NATO. This is Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Fox News last night.
We are going to have to reexamine whether or not this alliance that has served this country well for a while is still serving that purpose, or is it now become a one-way street where America is simply in a position to defend Europe, but when we need the help of our allies, they're going to deny us basing rights and they're going to deny us overflight?
A drone attack sparked a large fire at Kuwait International Airport this morning, according to Kuwaiti state media. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia says it intercepted and destroyed two Iranian drones. Bahrain also said it's working to extinguish a fire at a business facility that resulted from an Iranian attack. A tanker also came under attack off the coast of Qatar earlier today. Israeli strikes in southern Beirut killed at least seven people Tuesday, according to Lebanon's health ministry. It comes as Israel says it will keep control of southern Lebanon, establish a new security zone, and destroy all homes in Lebanese villages near the Israeli border after its war with Hezbollah ends. Israel's killed more than 1,200 people in Lebanon since it resumed its war with Hezbollah, according to Lebanon's health ministry. More than a million people have been forced to flee their homes. This is Lebanon's Minister for Social Affairs.
I think this is a very a different character from the previous war. Different regions that have been targeted. And you have also the fact that host communities are tired. And this is another challenge, ensuring the social cohesion.
A U.S. journalist was kidnapped in Baghdad Tuesday. Shelley Kittleson is a U.S. freelance journalist based in Rome who's covered the Middle East. According to police, Kittleson was seized by four men in civilian clothes and taken in a vehicle. The State Department said it had previously warned Kittleson of threats against her and is coordinating with the FBI to secure her release. President Trump says he plans to attend Supreme Court oral arguments today on his executive order ending birthright citizenship. It would be the first time a sitting president would be present during oral arguments at the Supreme Court. Critics call it a dangerous assault on the independence of the judiciary. President Trump signed the executive order seeking to end birthright citizenship on his first day back in office. A series of lower courts blocked it, ruling the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment guarantees citizenship to anyone born on U.S. soil. Here's President Trump speaking to reporters yesterday.
And this is not about Chinese billionaires or billionaires from other countries who all of a sudden have 75 children or 59 children in one case or 10 children becoming American citizens. This was about slaves. And if you take a look, slaves, we're talking about slaves from the Civil War.
In an 8-1 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled against a law that banned conversion therapy for LGBTQ children in Colorado. The challenge to Colorado's ban is led by Christian licensed counselor Kaylee Childs, who argued the ban is a violation of her First Amendment rights to free speech and religion. Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was the only dissenting vote. The ACLU of Colorado said in a statement, quote, this case is a major blow to the rights of LGBTQ plus youth, not only in Colorado, but across our country. Conversion therapy has no place in our country. Attempts to change an individual's sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression causes severe, lasting psychological harm to LGBTQ plus youth, the ACLU said. So-called conversion therapy has been widely discredited by medical organizations, including the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. Federal immigration agents will reportedly be stationed at an upcoming Marine Corps graduation in Parris Island, South Carolina, raising fears for undocumented families attending the event. The agents are reportedly charged with identifying whether any of the graduates' family members are undocumented. Thousands of non-U.S. citizens have served in the military, with advocates condemning the deportation of veteran service members and their relatives under Trump and other U.S. administrations. In related news, a federal judge in Boston has ordered the Trump administration to restore protections and deportation relief for tens of thousands of immigrants who entered the U.S. through a parole process under President Biden. The Biden administration established the CBP One app in 2023 to allow immigrants to make appointments to petition for asylum at ports of entry and the southern border. Judge Allison Burroughs ordered the Trump administration to reverse its policy, which ordered as many as 900,000 immigrants who'd use the app to leave the U.S. immediately. Tens of thousands of immigrants who received the notice have already left the U.S. voluntarily or have been deported. President Trump signed a sweeping executive order cracking down on mail-in voting as he escalates his attacks on voter access ahead of this year's midterm elections. The order seeks to create a list of U.S. citizens eligible to vote in each state, directing the U.S. Postal Service to mail ballots only to verified voters. Arizona's Democratic Secretary of State, Adrian Fuentes, said in a statement, quote, "This executive order is a disgusting overreach from the federal government and shows how little the Trump administration understands about election administration. We will not let this order stand without a fight and will meet the federal government in court," Fuentes said. Arizona is among several states the Trump administration has sued in order to access sensitive voter data. The state was also at the center of Trump's false claims of election fraud in 2020. In the last election, in the last month that President Trump voted in Florida, he mailed in his ballot. A federal judge has ruled President Trump's executive order defunding NPR and PBS is unconstitutional. Judge Randolph Moss of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia said in his ruling, quote, "The First Amendment draws a line which the government may not cross at efforts to use government power, including the power of the purse, to punish or suppress disfavored expression by others," unquote. President Trump's executive order last year spurred Congress to claw back $1.1 billion in federal funding for public media outlets, including PBS and NPR. Congress's rescission of the funds remains in place. Trump's executive order led to the closure of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which had funded public media in the United States for more than half a century. The White House called Tuesday's decision a ridiculous ruling by an activist judge and vowed to appeal. A federal judge has temporarily blocked construction of President Trump's White House ballroom, saying he doesn't have the authority to fund the $400 million project through private donors. U.S. District Judge Richard Leon also said President Trump does not have the power to remodel the White House without congressional approval, writing in his decision, quote, "The President of the United States is the steward of the White House for future generations of First Families. He is not, however, the owner," unquote. The lawsuit was brought by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Earlier this week, Trump told reporters the ballroom would be a shed for a massive military complex being built underneath. And Canadian diplomat, politician, and human rights advocate Stephen Lewis has died of cancer at the age of 88. Lewis served as the Canadian ambassador to the United Nations and led Ontario's Progressive New Democratic Party, the NDP. He was also the father of socialist activist and documentary filmmaker Avi Lewis, who has just been elected as head of Canada's New Democratic Party. Stephen Lewis spent decades advocating for global HIV/AIDS awareness, co-founding AIDS-Free World. From 2001 to 6, he served as the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. We spoke to him in 2012 as one of the largest international AIDS conferences concluded in Washington, D.C.
There's never a smidgen of that money available, Amy, for global public health. We're always struggling for the crumbs and the pennies from the table when we know the amounts of money that are available for other and more perverse purposes internationally. And that, too, has to end. And there we need voices in the G8 like those of President Obama to say, everything is distorted. The priorities are wrong. The human imperative is what should count. And we're making a grave mistake in our priorities.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S. and Israeli war in Iran enters its 33rd day, President Trump's preparing to address the nation about Iran tonight. On Tuesday, Trump said the war could end in the coming weeks.
What happens to the Strait, we're not going to have anything to do with, because these countries, China will go up and they'll fuel up their beautiful ships and they'll leave and they'll take care of themselves. There's no reason for us to do it. We hit them hard. We got rid of a lot of the radicalized lunatics along the strait. But if they want something, but I would say that within 2 weeks, maybe 2 weeks, maybe three, we're hitting them very hard. Last night we knocked out tremendous amounts of missile making facilities. We, as you probably read or wrote,
the U.S. will be gone or done with the war.
Two or three weeks.
Not 3 weeks. If it is,
we'll leave when we feel that they are, for a long period of time, put into the Stone Ages, and they won't be able to come up with a nuclear weapon. Then we'll leave. Whether we have a deal or not, it's irrelevant.
While President Trump's talking about the war ending, the Washington Post reported Sunday the Pentagon's preparing for ground operations in Iran if Trump chooses to escalate the war. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports the United Arab Emirates is pushing for a plan to open the Strait of Hormuz by force. To talk about the state of the war, we're joined by Ali Vaez. He's the Iran Project Director of the International Crisis Group. He also serves as senior advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. He is co-author of a new piece in Foreign Affairs headlined, "The Iran War Has Escaped Its Authors." What do you mean, Ali Vaez?
It's good to be with you, Amy. Well, of course, this war started as a war of choice. The president went into this conflict with a high degree of wishful thinking that it would be a quick win by decapitating the Iranian political system, and by the shock and awe of initial U.S. and Israeli attacks, the Iranian system will quickly capitulate. We know that CENTCOM had warned him against Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz, and he had dismissed those warnings and had said the Iranians would surrender before they would get a chance of closing the strait. And now we're in the second month of this conflict, and it has become a war of necessity for him, because unlike what he said yesterday, leaving this conflict without opening the strait would be a humiliating defeat for President Trump.
Can you talk about the latest, what's happening? First of all, you have this whole issue of President Trump claiming regime change. And I want to play a clip to talk about what this means as the U.S. and Israel kill one group of Iranian leaders after another. Talk about what that means and where you see this leadership right now. Can you hear me, Ali?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I thought you were going to show the clip. Yes, look, the regime in Iran indeed has changed, but it has changed and become a much more radical regime. It is still, of course, the Islamic Republic. It is not a fundamentally different political order, but its leadership is now in the hands of the most hardline elements within the Revolutionary Guards. Anyone with a degree of experience and a degree of moderation or pragmatism has been eliminated. So you're now left with the Revolutionary Guards, which is designated by the United States as a foreign terrorist organization, in charge of that country. Even individuals like the Speaker of Parliament, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, that the president believed could potentially play the role of Delcy Rodriguez in Venezuela and make deals with the United States, is a former commander of the Revolutionary Guards Air Force. And it's this entire strategy is based on a flawed understanding of how the Iranian system functions. This was never a totalitarian system similar to North Korea or to Syria, in which it's a pyramid sitting on its head, and if you remove the head, the whole thing will collapse and unravel. This was always a multi-center political structure with overlapping authorities and competing agendas, which in a time of crisis would actually ensure the durability of this political system. And that also means that there is no one like the Speaker of Parliament or whoever else remains at the end of this war at the helm would be able to do a deal with the U.S. that would be politically compromising for them, because there are other power centers and they would check each other out. So this is why, in fact, what he has created is a much more radicalized and militarized political structure in Iraq.
I want to go to White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt speaking on Monday.
Some of the previous leaders who are now no longer on planet Earth because they lied to the United States and they strung us along in negotiations, and that was unacceptable to the president, which is why many of the previous leaders were killed.
Your response, Ali Vaez.
Well, let's remember that it was the United States that withdrew from a deal with Iran in 2018 under President Trump's first term in office, not the Iranians, who were complying by their obligations, as verified by the UN nuclear watchdog. And the amount of time that the Trump administration in its second term has spent with Iranian counterparts negotiating, five rounds in 2025 and three rounds in 2026, Amy, if you put it all together, is less than a week. And if that is considered prolonging negotiations, I think probably the Trump administration doesn't have a good sense of how deal-making is done.
Talk about the thousands of paratroopers, U.S. military, that are being brought into the Persian Gulf area, and the significance of what this means, the possibility that Harg Island and the significance of it would be invaded or islands nearby, and what it means for President Trump to say he may end the war before he controls the Strait of Hormuz. He has also said he wants it called the Strait of Trump, and he might pull out of NATO if they don't help.
Well, this is the typical mixed messages coming from President Trump, that it's unclear that what is it that exactly he wants. On the one hand, he threatens Iran with war crimes, destroying its energy infrastructure, flattening cities and civilian infrastructure if the strait is not opened. And then on the other hand, he says it's somebody else's problem. And if NATO doesn't help, the U.S. would withdraw from NATO. So typically, if you don't know where you're going, any road would take you there. But reality is that we are now at a critical juncture that the president would have to decide. And we'll see if he makes a statement along these lines in his speech tonight. But he either has to exit this war and accept that he hasn't been able to achieve most of his strategic objectives, because the regime is still in place. It is still firing rockets and drones and missiles towards U.S. bases, U.S. allies in the region, even at Israel, with much more efficiency and precision than was the case at the beginning of this war. It still has a pathway to nuclear weapons, because it still has almost half a ton of nuclear material that is unaccounted for. And the strait remains in control of Iran. Or the president would have to double down on escalation in order to try to open the strait. And there, the options are really unattractive. If he puts boots on the ground on any of these islands, U.S. troops would basically be sitting ducks for Iranian attacks from the mainland. And as we have seen in the case of the Red Sea with the Houthis, these attacks can happen from deep inside the mainland. And what is the U.S. going to do? Go further and further inland? This would be a Vietnam scenario. You start with air power, then you start with limited boots on the ground, then it becomes mission creep that lasts for months or years. Or if he goes after Iran's energy infrastructure, then the Iranians would torch the oil and gas facilities in Qatar and Saudi Arabia in the UAE, and that would push up the price of oil to above $250 a barrel, resulting in a global economic meltdown and a political fallout for President Trump in an election year.
Can you talk about at what point destabilization of the region breaks down the Gulf alliance? And talk about the position of each of the Gulf countries. The UAE has just said it may get involved with a military response. The word is that Saudi Arabia has been pushing Trump to continue the attacks on Iran. Talk about what's happening.
Well, typically, the Gulf countries are not on the same page. They are sort of on a spectrum. And on the one hand, you have countries like Oman, who would like to see this war end as soon as possible on mutually beneficial terms. Then you have countries like Qatar and Kuwait who understand that at the end of this war, the U.S. is going to leave and be occupied with other crises in the world, but they have to live with Iran for centuries to come. And so they don't want a zero-sum approach here, but they want a situation that is stable. And then you have Bahrain, the UAE, at the other end of the spectrum, who are much more hawkish on Iran and want Iran to be defanged in a way that this cannot happen again. And what that means exactly, they haven't really clarified, because the Houthis right next door in Yemen, which are a ragtag group of rebels, have not been defanged after years of Saudi and Emirati attacks on them. So it's unclear how a country of 92 million could be defanged. And then you have the Saudis kind of in between these two camps, because the Saudis have been involved in mediation efforts by the Egyptians, the Turks, and the Pakistanis that now China is supporting to try to resolve this crisis. But at the same time, I think they share some of the Emirati concerns about a situation in which Iran would feel emboldened at the end of this conflict, and especially if it remains in control of the traffic in the strait. It gives it some sort of coercive leverage that would be very uncomfortable for the Saudis. So they are on a spectrum, but at the end of the day, they also have very limited agency. This is a decision that President Trump will probably make without much consultation with them, and they are the ones who have to live with the consequences.
What do you think it's most important for President Trump to say tonight, given he has said things right across the spectrum?
Well, look, undoubtedly, he's going to put out a narrative of victory. He's going to talk about sinking the Iranian Navy, which was never a threat to begin with. Iran had a third world Navy with no possibility of power projection. Iran's capabilities has always been asymmetric. Its underwater drones, its mines, its cruise missiles that pose a threat. And those are the reasons that the strait remains closed. He would talk about killing the leadership of Iran and changing the regime. But again, as we discussed, none of that really means much. I think the most important thing would be to see if he has a set of realistic strategic objectives, and if he can match the ends and means, and he can basically define what an off-ramp would look like. If he is still seeking a set of maximalist demands that would amount to Iranian capitulation, that is just simply not on the cards. And it means that this conflict can go on for much longer, and the longer it goes on, the higher the cost and the risks for everyone.
Ali Vaez, I want to thank you for being with us, Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group. A link to your new piece, The Iran War Has Escaped Its Authors. Ali Vaez is speaking to us from Geneva, Switzerland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than a month into the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, concerns are mounting over the long-term consequences of war on human health, land and marine ecosystems and aquifers, as well as war's impact on global warming. Among many concerning incidents, Israel bombed oil facilities around Tehran in the first weeks of the war, causing fires to burn for hours, spawning a thick cloud of toxic smoke over the city of 10 million people. Many residents complained they had trouble breathing as black raindrops full of toxic chemicals fell across the capital. On Monday, President Trump threatened to blow up desalination plants in Iran. He wrote on Truth Social, quote, "If the Hormuz Strait is not immediately open for business, we'll conclude our lovely stay in Iran by blowing up and completely obliterating all of their electric generating plants, oil wells, and Kharg Island, and possibly all desalinization plants, exclamation point, which we have purposefully not yet touched," Trump said. In the Gulf, desalination is the primary source of potable water, and hundreds of desalination plants could be at risk if the conflict escalates. To talk more about this and more, we're joined by the Iranian environmental scientist Kaveh Madani. He's director of the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment and Health. Last month, he was awarded the 2026 Stockholm Water Prize for his pioneering work on the concept of water bankruptcy. Previously, he served as the deputy head of Iran's Department of Environment, but went into